Shirley MacLaine has been in show business since she was very young, but her big break came as a result of a bad break during the original Broadway production of The Pajama Game when Carol Haney, whom she was understudying, broke her ankle and Ms. MacLaine was told to take on the role without a rehearsal. Since then, she's appeared in more than 50 films, received an Academy Award for her performance in Terms of Endearment, and she's written 12 books. Her latest is Saging While Aging, and in it she reflects on those life moments as she ponders the spiritual and physical process of becoming older. The book is published by Atria, and I'm very pleased that it brings Shirley MacLaine to this show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
You started off as a dancer, and you came to New York at the age of 16 in hopes of making it big. Did you feel confident that you would be successful?
You know, I have had this feeling that I've had an angel on my shoulder my whole life, some kind of interesting guidance that I trusted. I never had a doubt. No, I didn't.
And in the book, you discuss the role that synchronicity has played in your life, particularly regarding show business.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe how that happened when you met Bob Fosse?
Oh, golly. Fosse has figured in my life. Let's see. All right. I went on for Haney. I did not have a rehearsal. When I got out of the subway, coming to the theater late from my own little performance in the chorus, he was there with Jerry Robbins, George Abbott, Hal Prince, etc., all the greats.
Oh, boy, the heavyweights.
Heavyweights. I said, what are you doing standing out here in the cold? And they said, you're on, Carol is off. Okay, long story short, I went on for Carol. It worked. Some years later, or maybe 2 years later, I'm sitting in Lou Wasserman's office, and he said, so what do you want to do, Mac? He used to call me Mac. Something else, Lou Wasserman. If we had Lou Wasserman, we wouldn't have a writer's strike right now. But anyway, so I said, I want to do Sweet Charity, and I want Fosse to direct it. He said, oh, he's just a choreographer. I said, no, he's going to be the best. Long story short, he did. Then he won all his Oscars and blah, blah, blah. Don't you know, Leonard, he died on the street from a heart attack almost in exactly in front of my old dancing class in Washington, D.C., before he went in for a rehearsal of the National Company of Sweet Charity.
And then talk about synchronicity. The film producer, Hal Wallace, was in the audience at that very first performance you did as a fill-in for Carol Haney. And that led to all sorts of other things.
Right. And then I went back in the chorus when she came back, when Carol Haney came back. And then I was out again in September because she had a sore throat. And who was there that night? Alfred Hitchcock. So that's what I mean. It was sort of all meant to be. And I've been trying to understand synchronicity and respect it and frankly write about it because it happens in everyone's life if they recognize it.
And Hitchcock put you in your first film, The Trouble with Harry. Mm-hmm. Did he tell you right from the start that he wanted to do something with you?
Mostly he told me to keep my husband off the set. He wouldn't let any men. He thought he was married to every actress he works with.
Oh, but you're not a blonde. You weren't a blonde. I thought it was only blondes.
No, he liked... I was a little pudgy then because if he fixed it so I could eat, you know, before I hadn't had that many good meals. I was living on peanut butter and lemonade. But anyway, he was instrumental, of course, in my learning experience and teaching me and... He was something Alfred Hitchcock was.
Well, when I look over the directors you worked with early in your career, that had to have been an education in itself. Hitchcock, who you say gave you certain ideas about acting that you applied the rest of your life. Yeah, have you worked with
Vincent?
No,
he never gave me acting ideas. He thought actors were cattle. That's really true.
That is true.
That's really true. He never said a thing to me. Except that I had the guts of a bank robber. That's all he told me.
Well, that's a nice thing
that's
to
nice.
Be told.
Gives you confidence.
But you worked with Vincent Minnelli. You worked with Billy Wilder. I mean, these are...
Nichols and William Wyler and Fosse and... I've worked with everyone but Zinnemann and David Lean.
That you wanted to work with.
that were the greats.
Your book deals a great deal with the spiritual journey that you've experienced throughout your life. When did that journey begin? You seem to suggest earlier that it started when you were very, very young.
It was. I was kind of a mystic. I always knew there was something more than what I could thump on and prove. I always had this feeling there was an otherness to things.
Well, you were brought up as a Baptist, weren't you?
Oh, I wasn't. Maybe I wasn't even brought up. I wasn't brought up with a sense of religion at all, no. In fact, that's one of the great things my parents did. They left that up to me.
So they didn't? You never discussed religion or spirituality with them?
Spirituality, another thing, because that really involves metaphysics. Religion, no. Metaphysics, yes.
What about your brother Warren? Do you think he was spiritual as well, or were you very siblings?
Huh?
Were you very different kinds of
very
siblings?
Very different, oppositionary about many things. He is
except politics.
Yeah, true. Well, listen, if you've got any brains at all, you're going to come down to a kind of almost libertarian point of view, it seems to me. And Warren's very libertarian. But he's a left-brained intellectual, and I'm a right-brained seeker, I guess you'd say.
For most people, these sorts of matters are kept generally private. What made you decide to share your spiritual journey with the rest of the world?
Well, I did start some time ago, didn't I? But I guess I had the feeling that we were headed in the wrong direction. And if we were headed toward more materialism and more mechanistic points of view and more of a kind of scientific, and if you can't prove it, it doesn't exist, reality, that wasn't good enough. Because I knew there was more going on, as we've just discussed. But I think I decided to write about it because I traveled so much. And, when I was 19, 20, 21, I'd already been around the world a couple of times. And the whole immersion of myself in other cultures and other places and other points of view, certainly other religions, etc., made me understand that we were just one country that had a rather mechanistic and a left-brained kind of limited point of view on what was real.
We're calling globalization today, do you think?
No, that's more to do with materialism. Mm-hmm. I think what has always interested me is it's the notion that we are, I guess because I'm an artist and started as a dancer who had to listen to the music and let the music sway me when it was very difficult to move the body. So there I am, combining spirit and body and mind. And I was very aware early on that this mind, body, and spirit amalgamation needed to be expressed and written about, and that's why I started writing.
My guest is Shirley MacLaine, whose latest book is Saging While Aging, published by, is it Atria? Atria.
Atria. It's a, what do you call it, thing of
it's an imprint of
Simon & Schuster, yeah.
And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the spirituality, your openness about it, has made you the butt of some jokes. Did you expect that?
Look, I never minded the jokes as long as they were funny.
And you once told me that you convinced Johnny Carson that you could write better Shirley MacLaine jokes than his writers were writing. And so you used to write his jokes
for him.
That's
right. That's true.
Well,
that's why, what are they going to do now with the writer's strike? I mean, because I'm in the guild too. I can't write my own jokes about myself. They'll probably go on hiatus. I don't know. I never minded it as long as it was funny. If it was really cruel. But there's a man who wrote Out on a Broken Limb. I've forgotten his name, but he came to one of my seminars and he really enjoyed himself. I think he would still write these things, but he understood what I was talking about. He never heard of meditation or things like that. And now what I was writing about with Out on a Limb is mainstream. I mean, let's face it. Some of the stuff I'm into now is not exactly mainstream yet, but it will be.
It's one of the reasons that you've written best-selling books, because there are enough people out there who feel connected.
There are. It's funny. I was looking at Jeannie Moss the other day, because apparently, well, I watched it. On the Democratic debate, Tim Russert asked Dennis Kucinich if it was true that he had seen a UFO, as reported in my new book, from my balcony. And he said yes, and he said he had. So Jeannie went out on the street and said, well, what do you think about a presidential candidate seeing a UFO? And apparently she concluded 50% of them said they would only vote for a presidential candidate who had seen a UFO. I thought that was funny.
You, one of your regrets is that you haven't had a connect, any kind of a personal connection
with an
extraterrestrial.
Yeah, I mean, every house I've ever lived in, the people who were staying in it when I was away had something, including my friends in New Mexico, et cetera. Well, New Mexico is the backyard of these things.
Is that why you've moved to New Mexico, so that you can enhance your chances?
You know, anybody who moves to New Mexico cannot answer why they moved there, and I'm one of them. Maybe it is that.
Well, it's a beautiful state.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous. I'm very happy there, and we'll stay there. I did see many crafts in Peru, but I didn't have a personal encounter like some of these other people.
Let's go back to the movies, because you started with Hitchcock, and as I said, you worked with a lot of great directors, and you talked about working with most of them. Do you think that movies have changed a lot over the years?
Oh, God, Leonard, you know, come on.
Well, you came along at the time when the studio system was just kind of phasing out.
Uh-huh. No, but what's happened to it now is it's all about money. And violence makes money, fear makes money, hardware makes money, and all that business. So the pictures that I was used to and wished that they would still do more of are character-driven films. And, you know, they're relegated and marginalized to independent films.
Although I gather this is the year of the adult film. We're going to start having films aimed at people over a certain age demographic, at least in this coming season, perhaps because we go through these pendulum swings, a lot of explosions and car crashes and the like, and then those films don't do as well, and there's a hope that something else will do well. Mm-hmm. But in the old days, I mean, you just went from The Trouble with Harry to Some Came Running, mm-hmm. although in that film you were cast with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. And although you stole the film, did you feel at all intimidated?
I don't know what intimidation means.
Well, when you're working with big, really big stars.
No, I don't know that. I don't get it. I think they're just people who are trying their best. I can see underneath really powerful, very talented, and sometimes aggressive people. I can see the softness underneath. It's like that really hard role on the outside and soft on the inside. No, I was never intimidated by them. I can't remember being, frankly, intimidated by anybody, which could be a problem.
Well, they obviously liked you, for that reason, because you were also in the original Ocean's 11,
mm-hmm.
and you were dubbed the only female member of the Rat Pack.
Mm-hmm.
When you saw the remake of that film, were you upset at all?
Oh, no. It was George Clooney and his gang getting together and doing whatever, like Frank had done with us earlier. No. It was a terrible movie. All of them are.
What about when they revived some of the things that you appeared in on stage? Are you perfectly happy? Do you go and see? Well, I don't know. Well, they did a pajama game afterward. Would you go to see that and say, oh, gee, they missed the point? Or are you perfectly happy to see other people try different approaches?
Yeah, I was a little upset with the lack of respect for Jerry Robbins and Bob Fosse, particularly Steam Heat. Mm-hmm. That bothered me in Pajama Game. But the others, they've been okay. I enjoyed the Pajama Game show. What else?
What about Sweet Charity, which has been done a number of times?
Oh, that's terrific every time, because no one's trying to redo it, you know.
In the book, you describe your work on The Apartment as an act of pure trust, because you started filming with only 29 pages of the script. Billy Wilder didn't want you to know what was going on?
I think he didn't know what he was going to do.
He was writing it as he was filming?
Yeah, he was looking at the chemistry between Jack and me, and he knew that I played gin every weekend with Dean and Frank and Ernie Kovacs, remember him?
Mm-hmm.
That's why he put the gin game in there. But he wanted to see how it worked with Lemon and me. And then he went home and wrote every night.
So he based it on the chemistry that the two of you mm-hmm. developed.
Well, he had an outlined idea of what he wanted to do.
But then you also had to create a character without knowing what she was going to be doing well, down the road.
Okay. I got to learn her every day, too.
We'll take a little break, and maybe we'll listen to a clip from The Apartment and then come back with more of this conversation with Shirley MacLaine, whose latest book is Saging, SAGE-ING, While Aging, AGE-ING, from Atria Books. Stay with us.
For a while there, you tried kidding yourself that you're going with an unmarried man. Then one day he keeps looking at his watch and asks you if there's any lipstick showing, then rushes out to catch the 7:14 to White Plains. So you fix yourself a cup of instant coffee and you sit there by yourself and you think. And it all begins to look so ugly.
I just think that more people are interested in that reincarnation stuff than you think.
Well, I didn't say they aren't. I'm going to talk about reincarnation with you, Shirley. MacLaine is here. Her book, Saging While Aging, published by AJ. Okay, let's talk about that right away. You discuss reincarnation here, and you describe how you lived on the lost continent of Atlantis as one form of self. In interviews, you've also described your life as a Moorish girl who bore several children to Charlemagne. How did these visions of your past selves appear to you?
Yeah, this is really interesting. When you get into two things, when you learn to meditate deeply and you have read enough of Einstein, you understand the truth of the fact that time is not linear and that it is all happening concurrently, all happening now. In other words, all of the past and the future are happening now. Now, that's scientific. So what I began to experience in meditation was the bleeding through of some of these lifetimes. And it's quite astonishing. It didn't scare me. I knew it was real, at least for me. I knew that my soul had been on a journey of many thousands and probably millions of years. And the fact that I had lived before and will live again is, to me, absolutely the same as walking upright.
Well, how did they affect your sense of history?
Interesting, because in some of the cases, I remembered living at times that I had read about with a real emotional involvement, like the French Revolution or the Founding Fathers here in this country. I'm sure that I lived during the time of the Founding Fathers and knew Benjamin Franklin, and I knew Robert Morris, who was the financier of the American Revolution.
How is it different than déjà vu?
Same. Mm-hmm.
Already. So you think there. That if I have an experience of déjà vu, I'm very likely experiencing some kind of connection with a past life?
Yet something has happened to you before. And it made such sense to me, particularly when I spent so much time in Asia and India, that the soul is living in the body, and we are walking around as living souls who have lived many, many times.
Can this be applied to your present life? For example, do you think about things that happened in past lives and then apply them to problems or things you're going through?
Yeah, you know what I apply now, and it's really interesting, is synchronicity. I'm very much more aware now in my elderly years than I was earlier that everything is happening as a kind of a map, a kind of a created reality that we must have made up. For example, I'm finding if I need to study something and I don't know where to go, the library, or I don't use the net very well, I'll turn on the television and there is that subject right there on Discovery or something. I need to talk to someone, don't know where they are, what they call me. All that sort of stuff happens to me all the time, and I'm so much more aware of it, and I respect it. And once I respect it, it amplifies.
I had that synchronicity experience I mentioned that I saw some came running, and then the next day I came to work, and they said, oh, guess who's coming on the show? Mm-hmm. Shirley MacLaine. Mm-hmm. Well, how does this affect the way you picture the future?
Oh, that's a big question, Leonard. Oy, oy, oy. Well, that's probably...
Or doesn't it?
Oh, sure it does. This is why I'm now writing about star beings and so interested in my research and the people who have had experiences, all the astronauts, a couple of presidents. I mean, this is very well-spoken material. It's not, you know, me being wacky or anything. But they are talking about a lot of the people that I've spoken with who have been aboard the crafts speak of the teachings of the star beings about what we are doing to our planet. Well, we know what Al Gore is saying, and we certainly know we're doing it ourselves, but they are taking this extremely seriously, and we really have to stop or we're in big trouble. So I'm looking at, oh, man, what could that mean? Mm-hmm. How many of the truth pictures that Al Gore makes do we have to see before we begin to, and you know, for China to bring all the people in from the countryside and have them go to work at cleaning up the environment and shutting down the factories so the air will be clean for the Olympics, that's fine. Why don't they do it every day, every year? So we've got some big problems about that, and I'm worried about that for the future, and I tie that in with what I'm hearing from people who have had contact with star beings, because that's what they're worried about more than anything.
So these extraterrestrials, which you call star beings, are concerned about how we are destroying our own planet?
Absolutely.
Why would they care?
Because it has an effect on the entire cosmos. If this planet is destroyed, the atmosphere feels it, and the outer ionosphere feels it, etc. And besides, they care about us, and they don't want to see, in some cases, what they consider their children to be self-destructive.
You say that the American government is much less likely to acknowledge alien visitors than the governments of other countries.
Well, apparently there's been the countries that have released their star visitor files are Brazil, France. By the way, when they released them in France, the number of inquiries shut down the net systems. It was quite extraordinary. China. I can't remember all the countries that have, but there have been, I think, Venezuela, maybe Argentina. I know I talked to President Menem in Argentina about this, and he had his military investigating. He knew that it was real. Carter and I have talked about this. He had his own encounter. You know, he wrote about it. So I have all the astronauts. So many astronauts have talked about it, and oh, people like Kennedy. The U.S. Air Force assures me that UFOs pose no threat to national security. I like that approach. He knew they were there. He wanted to know what they were. He was not afraid. Reagan had his encounters. I could quote you lots of people, but the important thing is that I think we're in a real crisis.
Well, you say, although you don't support the election of George Bush, you say in the book, it was meant to happen. So you're also a fatalist?
Very good question. Yeah, not a fatalist, but we did, after all, elect him in enough numbers that he's the president. So I think he's the president for our learning experience. And I think the learning experience revolves around the need to understand taking responsibility in a democracy.
This is like when they say about an alcoholic, you had to hit rock bottom.
Absolutely right. We have to hit rock bottom in our opinion of our president before we start to take responsibility and our own power back. Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure there are that every conservative in America would see it that way.
Oh, I'm sure not. But let me hear what they like about it.
You note that we are all playing the same parts over and over again in life after life. What do you suggest we do to change those human scripts?
I think if we were more in touch with our aligned destiny, and here's where I agree with the Dalai Lama. I can't see a better way to do it than going within. To read about all of the stuff in the New Age libraries, yes, of course. But the real expert is oneself. And to go within one's own inner power is the way to get in touch with what you're supposed to be doing. I mean, some people need to write about metaphysical subjects like me. I'm sure that I'm in alignment with my destiny to write about these UFOs and what they mean and what they're saying, what they're trying to say, and how they long to be acknowledged so they can help us. That's my destiny. You have a destiny of having people like me on your show and many others who disagree with everything I'm saying. Everyone has a destiny, really, and it's important to get in touch with them.
My guest is Shirley MacLaine, whose latest book is Saging While Aging from Atria Books. Well, we have to work hard to change our human scripts. Mm-hmm. But as an actress, I'm sure you've thought about this. As an actress, you might have had to have fought playing the same kinds of roles again and again as well.
Well, what's so interesting about the way my mind works is that I am an artist. I am a creator of my own reality whenever I go on a set or a stage or play another character. So I'm in touch with what it means to have the accoutrement of, let's say, the wardrobe, the makeup, the hair, the props, the script. That's what being an artist means, and it's probably why people of great minds say the artists will last longer than the politicians or the scientists, because the artists are in touch with the creativity of one's own reality. So, yes, I've had to look at the parts I've played. You know, I used to play these cute little victim parts and loved it. But I was in kind of that mentality, but coming into learning that I really knew much more than I realized I knew.
And the ditzy dame, to some degree, also the Judy Holliday part. We love her. Mm-hmm. She's really got a lot more than is obvious if we just look
at her. Also, I knew that Judy Holliday had an IQ of 174. You know, we knew that. I don't know that mine is like that, but I do know that I've always known there was more to me than I had recognized. And as I get older and experience the more part of me, I like playing these women that are, ballsy and sometimes impossible and seem to have a sense of command of their environment completely, you know.
And do you think that because of that you're getting offered certain kinds of roles? Because youth is such a commodity in Hollywood. There was a time when Betty Davis could be in her 60s and she'd still be playing somebody in her 40s. That you don't see that much anymore.
I don't understand. No, there are no parts for women much at all now.
Yeah.
Betty Davis complained always about not enough parts for her own real age. But, you know, she always seemed 40 when she was 12. So that was not all that different for her. I think it's a real problem that we do not yet understand what the female sensibility is on about, what we mean, what we talk about. It's not just feminism.
But aren't women writing movies these days and directing films?
Oh,
Why do you think it's still not happening?
It's not enough. Not enough women have, I suppose, that self-esteem to think they can do it. And frankly, not enough women think they have enough to say that matters. And the other thing is that the feminine point of view is more hidden. Almost like the genitalia, you know? It's really there to be discovered, to be understood, that the power is within. The masculine point of view, the power is obvious and without. So what we need to do is feel more comfortable with the withinness of each of us, including the men, by the way.
Well, in the November 2007 issue of Vanity Fair, that's this current issue, you listed your dog Terry as your greatest love. You even wrote a book out on a leash about your fear of being separated from Terry during the filming of a movie in the United Kingdom. Now, you've been linked with some pretty impressive men over the years. Robert Mitchum, Pete Hamill, Yves Montand, Olaf Palme, even Danny Kaye. And yet a dog is the love of your life.
It's like my pillow says, the more I know of men, the more I love my dog. They're okay. I'm over them.
We all love our dogs. I have a very lovable dog. But does Terry have some special abilities?
Oh, I think so. That's why I wrote Out on a Leash. Don't you love that title?
Mm-hmm. Out on a Limb, that was very clever.
Yeah, it was. My publisher was afraid to tell me. It was his suggestion, not mine. I was not that bright. No, Terry, I know I've lived with Terry before. I lived with Terry in Egypt. I'm convinced of that. I've had dreams about it. We've talked about it. I think she was and looks like Anubis. And the Anubis was the god of the hidden world. Mm-hmm. And she has taught
Egyptians love dogs and cats.
Well, they know that the sensibility and consciousness of these animals is much wiser than we give them credit for.
Well, in the Hindu belief system, you can come back as something other than a human. Do you believe that you could come back as something
else?
No,
that's called transmigration of souls. I had a discussion about that with Nehru once on a plane. We sat next to each other. We had a long talk about transmigration of souls. And we agreed that in the ancient Hindu texts that where there might have been a time when the soul wanted experience living in the animal kingdom, it desired to be more individuated. And that habit, let's say, that sense of reincarnation, what you would come back as again, was dispensed with. Yes, we come back as revolving sexes. Yes, sometimes female, sometimes male. But it's funny, at the end of our conversation, Prime Minister Nehru and I talking about this, that's not true anymore. There was a fly there in the cabin, and I went to swat it, and he said, "Don't do that. It might have been your grandmother."
Does this make you feel any more comforted as you grow older?
It does, because I know I'm not going to die. I know that. I got over that a long time ago. I know the soul will go on. And some of the stuff I write about in the book here about Michael Newton's work, Life Between Lives, I thought that was fascinating. Did you?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really interesting because he's been through like 10,000 patients, and his particular destiny was not to help them get in touch with their past life experience, but their life between lives experience. And they all said the same thing. They went through the tunnel and the white light and were met by either relatives or loved ones or something important, someone important to them. And then they went through this education in what they would only call heaven. And after the education was completed to a certain extent, they decided what they, their soul, wanted to work on next.
We have very little time, but I just wondered whether you relate differently to people, whether they share your spiritual beliefs.
No, not at all. Someone who doesn't
matter.
As long as they've got a sense of humor, it's okay with me. Of course, I used to be wondering myself. No, I don't. People don't have to agree with me for me to be friends. No.
Do you ever wonder what it would have been like if you hadn't been an actress? What your life would have been like?
I think it was my destiny. I think I chose to do this. I think I'm choosing to do what I'm doing now. If I had not followed my destiny, I think I would be probably a drug addict or an alcoholic, and maybe that's what's happening to these young women in Hollywood. They're not following their destiny. I don't know. I would not have been as happy as I am now.
And I wouldn't have met you. So. Shirley MacLaine's latest book is Saging While Aging. It is published by Atria Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Terrific. Like you. Loud. You're nice.
On tomorrow's show, after telling us about America's Greatest Generation, Tom Brokaw now turns his attention to a decade that transformed American society, the 60s, and then a look at the lively correspondence of the six Mitford sisters, also Chuck Close, who began reinventing portraiture almost four decades ago, and 40 years of settlements in Israel and how they have polarized Israelis and Palestinians. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Blakeney Schick, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angela Sheldon, Stephanie Hughes, and Rachel Krantz. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.